Hello, Gary. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Thank you for being on the show today. So tell us about, I've been reading the book. I think it is a great read. And so just tell us about what prompted you to write this story. And you've written several.
What's interesting about this whole thing is, maybe or maybe not, it's very appropriate for the way many people are feeling today. So that title, because it was part of the feeling I had as I went about some of the work I did back when I was in the Navy, and I was doing some covert work for the United States government. And some days it would be like to live or maybe not. I might make it through today, but then again, I might not. So many people today, just going about their daily lives, they feel that way, you know? Because of the pandemic, to have lunch or going to the store, you know? The title is very appropriate. I decided to start promoting the book this year, but I didn't know how it would all come into play, you know?
Yeah, so you come from a big family.
Well, yeah, I had two brothers, a sister, and then I had a younger brother from my stepfather. And now I have six children and 10 grandchildren.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
So let's just start talking about the book. It does start out to be really... It starts out to be really kind of exciting. So just tell us about the beginning of the book and the progression of the book.
Well, I'll tell you how this came about. In the late 1990s, I began to talk to some movie producers about the story of my investigation of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
Okay.
And I investigated that in 1977 in association with the House Select Committee on Assassinations. But because of things that happened, I couldn't talk about it. I had to just shut up and go away. I waited about 20 years before I felt like I was comfortable even talking about it. And so when I started talking about it a few years later, I felt like I had to start writing things down. It was really for therapy for myself that I began to write that book. I went back to when I was born in Floral, Alabama, which is a real small town on the Florida-Alabama line there. So Flo, F-L-O-R-A-L-H, Alabama, Florella, that's right on the border. And Then when I was five, one day my mother just packed us all up and left my dad because he had been beating her up. He came home that day to an empty house. But I was aware that he had been beating her up. Even before I was five, he would beat my mother up. I grew up mostly in Florida, graduated high school in Bonner Bay. I had two brothers in the Navy, and they asked me to take a test to apply for the Naval Academy. To my local Congressman Robert Sykes, you know, he would appoint someone to the Naval Academy each year, and they asked me to take that test. But I didn't wait to hear back because I had two brothers in Vietnam in the Navy, and I just hadn't joined them. They were listening, man. And once I got in boot camp, they called me into the personnel office and said my congressman had communicated with them that I need to apply for their office and training program.
Wow, that's really interesting. So with the fact that you got into the service and you started working in the intelligence agency, so what you did was a secret.
Yes, a drug interdiction. I did some counter-espionage stuff, and I had been made, basically. They had found out who I was, and it was for my best interest to go ahead and just accept an honorable discharge. Even though I'd had a temporary commission to Lieutenant JD for a while, because you have to have that to do certain kinds of work. So, I just took a regular honorable discharge as an enlisted man, and I had been singing in a nightclub there. We had a private club. So it was run by the government, but it was a private company. And I was singing in that club one night. And at a break, a man came and gave me his card. And said, when you get him, they knew I was going to be getting out of the Navy. I didn't notice it, but then I just stuck it in my pocket. And later on, when I got back to my room on the day, I looked at it, and it was an agent from Hollywood, California. So that's why I went to Hollywood.
Okay, so Hollywood. You are a musician. You play what? What kind of instruments do you play? You play the guitar. How cool! That is great. That is great. So I want to talk about Michael Jackson. Tell me the story about Michael Jackson and how you met him.
In 1993, I believe it was, I had six children. Oh, yes, they're all very talented, music and all. And my daughter, Rebecca, was at come and sing background music for Michael Jackson on his one of his tour recordings. And so we went to A&M Records in Hollywood, and that's where I met Michael's people, some of them. And that day I heard a story that some of the people were talking. And I first heard it, I just said, oh, that's BS. I can't even stand here and listen to that. Because there's somebody talking about Michael Jackson had a record before Motown. And you know, I knew that Motown discovered Michael Jackson.
Right.
So when I heard that, I just thought, I got to get out of here. This is such, you know, I can't even listen to this. But then as I turned and started to walk away, something hit me. What if it's true? You know?
Okay.
So I stopped and went back and just overheard it. But that was my first take on what I was about to come for me. And then a few days later, a gentleman by the name of Ben Brown called me and said I'd like to meet with you and talk to you. And I said, well, is it about business? And he said, yeah, it's about business. And I said, at the time I was working, I was doing management consulting, and I would charge $250 an hour to do that. So I said, well, you know, it costs $250 an hour for management consulting, whether we're having lunch or whatever, I still got to charge you. He said, you won't want any money for this because it's about Michael Jackson. And I said, well, all right, okay. So I met him and his wife at Musso's Bank Grill there on Hollywood Boulevard. And that's when I heard the story. I sat there with him and his wife, Joanne. And for 2 hours, I listened as he told me the true story about Michael Jackson. And he asked me to help him get that true story out so the world would know. That's how it started.
Wow. That is amazing. So Michael was actually a star, or aspiring to be a star, and he was already singing and writing music way before Motown?
That's right. Ben Brown and another gentleman by the name of Gordon Keith had a little label called Field Town Records in Gary, Indiana. And since Gary was a field town, you know, that kind of matched there, you know. But they had discovered Michael Jackson. They are the ones who went and talked to Joe Jackson. They recorded their first record, which was titled Big Boy, and it was a hit. It was a regional hit there in the Gary, Indiana, Chicago area, long before, a year or so before a Motown.
So was it supposed to never even be talked about? How did that just never be discussed? How did we never know that?
Well, that's exactly what happened when they signed with Berry Gordy. Berry Gordy was a very shrewd, smart, and talented man. You know, and he knew the record business. He knew publicity. And he said, okay, we're going to use Diana Ross, who's a big star. If you say something about Diana Ross, people are going to listen. So we're going to say that she discovered Michael Jackson. Because that's a better story than he got a record in Gary, Indiana.
Okay.
So when Michael met Diana, and he fell in love with her, well, he had admired her, you know, anyway, but he would have done anything she said, you know. And so she told him, at their first meeting, she told him, his age came up, and she said, well, you're not that age, you're a couple, actually, I think he was 11 or something then, and she said, you're 8 years old, you know. She said, well, okay. And then she said, and we, you know, and I discovered you, Motown discovered you. So the official story from then on was that she was discovered by Diana Ross, and they just ignored their past. Now, here's the thing about that. The sad thing about that, you do that to a young boy, and they had the whole family had to go by that. They had to keep their mouth shut. But especially you do that to a young boy, you can't say, you got to live a lie for the rest of your life. That's not good. That does something to a human being that they can never really shake. And the truth is, the sad thing about all of this, besides the sexual molestation that Michael had to experience even before that, is that poor Michael, his life really became a nightmare.
Wow. So it's kind of like the kids say today, you made that up. So that's exactly what they did. They made up a story.
Exactly.
And told it, and he had to follow it.
Exactly.
Wow. So that is a mess. It's all in the book, okay?
Yeah, all the details are in the book.
Okay. So now you are in Hollywood, and you are starting your music career.
Well, I started singing when I was 15. I had my first rock and roll band when I was 15 years old. My mother bought a guitar for me when I was 15. I taught myself to play, and within a few months, I had put together my first band.
Wow.
Yeah. When I went to Hollywood, within 2 months of getting to Hollywood, I was in Capitol Records. The first recording studio I ever walked in my life was Capitol Records at Hollywood and Vine in Hollywood, California, where the Beatles had recorded, Frank Sinatra had recorded. So many hit records that came out of that studio. And I was in there recording when I was I had just turned 20. I wasn't even 21 yet. I was in there recording my first record.
Wow. Oh, wow. So are you still recording?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, my latest single is out. It's called To Live or Maybe Not. It's a theme song for my book, To Live or Maybe Not. And it's just a simple guitar vocal recording I wrote and recorded in 30 minutes.
Okay, so I read in the book that you fell in love with this young girl and wrote a song. Did she ever get to hear you sing that song?
My first love song I wrote when I was like about 9, maybe 10, you know. And she never knew that I was in love with her. Yeah, because we only lived in Dunedin, Florida. They're near town, St. Petersburg. They're out by Clearwater on the beach there. And we only lived there about a year, and then we moved to Safety Harbor. So that was just one of those things.
So tell me about, I read in the book about your dancing contest when you were in the sixth grade. Tell me about that.
Well, that was another just fabulous experience. It was something, you know, things like that have happened to me. At the end of the year there at Safety Harbor Elementary School, each year they had a dance for the sixth graders who were leaving grammar to go to junior high. During these dance programs, they had a dance contest, and then they gave like a free Coke back then, you know. That was a big prize, a free Coke to the winner, right? And this particular night, see, I had learned to dance in a bar. My mother had owned a bar in Niceville, Florida, called Marie's Place. And I had learned to dance there. The waitresses taught me to dance, you know, with the jukebox music and stuff. And that's also in the book, To Live or Maybe Not. My mother had shot and killed a man there at that bar.
Right.
But that's where I learned to dance. So I knew how to dance. I spent a lot of nights dancing with the waitresses, you know. So that night, I was new at that school. And they said, well, y'all pair up and, you know, start dancing and whoever wins, you know. And I noticed across the way there was very tall, I was probably the shortest boy in the class. And there was a very tall girl. And, I mean, she had a beautiful spirit, but I can't say she was beautiful, you know. But anyway, I waited a minute and nobody asked her to dance. And there were other some prettier girls around. But I just thought to myself, you know what, I'm going to ask her to dance. So I went and asked her, because I figured nobody would ask her, you know, because she was tall. Guys didn't like girls taller than them back then.
Right.
So she could really dance, too. So we just really went crazy, man. We danced and danced, and I kept having people leave, you know, until they finally got to where. And we just kept, and we won the dance contest.
So you have had a very, very interesting life. You have lived kind of all over that Alabama, southern, or Gulf side of Florida, and then California. And Georgia.
I lived in Georgia, and I lived from New York to Hollywood, Memphis, Nashville. Now I've been in Texas the last several years. You know, I've had a real good run, so to speak.
Okay. All right. So now let's go ahead and get to the Martin Luther King story. You're going to do a movie. So tell us about that and why you feel like you know the real truth about this, about the assassination.
I was living in Nashville, Tennessee at the time. I was singing and recording with Acuff Rose, which back then was the number one country music publisher in the world. And one of my partners was an attorney named Jack Kershaw. And because of my experience in the Navy, I had some investigative experience. I would do special work for him. People only knew me as a friend of Jack Kershaw and a songwriter. So he became the attorney for James Earl Ray, the House Select Committee on Assassination. They said to investigate and get to the truth of the John F. Kennedy assassination and the Martin Luther King assassination. Now, what I learned later on, that basically that's what they said, but that wasn't really what they intended to do. What it really was just to appease the people and make the people think that they wanted the truth out. So, but anyway, that's when Jack asked me to investigate the King assassination. And I began work on that when I met Richard Sprague at Brushing Mountain Prison at the first interview that the House Select Committee attorney. He was chief counsel for the House Select Committee. And then he encouraged us, commissioned us to go and find the real killers. He really wanted to find the real killers of Martin Luther King. But then a week later, he was fired. So see, that just gives you a feel of what I was facing. They wanted me to investigate, but they didn't want me to really find and tell the truth about what I found.
So they wanted just to say, they just wanted to say, oh, we investigated this and we found nothing.
Well, I found out the truth, and the truth is James Earl Ray did not do it. James Earl Ray did not kill Martin Luther King.
You know, I believe that. I really do. I believe that because this is not the first time I've heard that. But
let me tell you, you have heard it from the horse's mouth now. You've heard from the man who actually investigated it, who actually went to the mobsters and to the undercover people and to the government people and actually found the truth about it. I'm the real thing. I'm not like an author who is writing something that they researched and somebody else told them that they did. I'm the one who actually did it and found the truth about what it was. That's the difference.
So you say that that Moxon is the one who wanted Martin Luther King dead.
Yeah, that was very much part of it. It was a group of people who had a similar, a little bit of this. The mob was concerned. They were concerned about Martin Luther King on April 4th, 1967. Martin was at the Riverside Church in New York, and he came against the Vietnam War. Well, they needed black soldiers in Vietnam, you know, and they didn't want to hear about, you know, people not wanting to join the military because they were against the Vietnam War. That's when Martin really took that step across the line. You know, he was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, but to them, when he did that,
okay, so what I don't understand is the connection with the mafia and the Vietnam War. Make that connection for me.
I can explain that to you. When I started investigating this, one of the things I did was I got statistics from the DEA and from other governments, you know, and files, and I found that throughout the 1960s, the mafia, organized crime, the mafia, they made about $30 billion a year from heroin that came from Burma, is right there by Vietnam. It came right down the Delta, right down the river there, and it got shipped to the United States and to other places. And the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, the U.S. government forces protected that shipping route for the mafia. And that was because the Italians wanted to keep control of it because there was a Chinese mob and there was other mobsters who wanted that. But the Italian mafia had kind of a semi-quasi relationship with our intelligence services because they worked together on certain things. So it was convenient for us, for our military, for our intelligence services to allow that to happen. But these drugs, you know, was on our streets and was killing people. But that was just what was called a, you know, just like, you know, that was just like a circumstantial, something that just came from it that didn't really matter. But what mattered to them was that they were making $30 billion a year, you know, organized crime. That's all the money back then. And that they were conveniently working with our intelligence services on things that they wanted them to do. It would have been against the law if they had to do it legally. If they had to do it without it being undercover, so to speak. So the mob, when Martin Luther King took a stand against the Vietnam War, he was throwing a shoe at the Italians. And he was saying, I don't care if you are making $30 billion a year. I'm saying, we got to get out of Vietnam. So that's why the organized crime and the CIA, the people in the CIA who hated John F. Kennedy because of the Bay of Pigs thing went down the wrong way that they didn't want it to go. They was out from that day on. They wanted him dead, and the mob wanted him dead. So together, that's a powerful force in this world. If you get the U.S. intelligence services and the mob, both of them together warning you out, you're probably going to die.
I got some of it. You were talking, it had to do with drugs then.
Yeah, the heroin market. It was called the heroin pipeline, which came from Burma, which is Myanmar now, I think it's the name of the country now, but it was right there by Vietnam, and it came down the Mekong River. Right to the Delta, they shipped it down there and then around and to the U.S., but the U.S. government's military protected their route so that no other crime organization, that's $30 billion a year for the Italian crime family. So,
okay, so let me ask you this. There was a movie done not too long ago from about John Lucas and the heroin trade and through the Vietnam, and they were shipping it over from Vietnam to here in the casket. Do you remember that story? Okay.
Yeah, well, I heard about that in 1977 too when I was investigating the King assassination, I found that's true. Some of the drugs actually came to America in caskets. That's absolutely true.
Wow. So King and Kennedy both were kind of in the way of that, especially if you're speaking against the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and John F. Kennedy had sent a letter to the security. He had let it known. He not only sent a letter, but he had let them know, I want out of Vietnam. In the letter, he said, I want 1,000 troops back by the end of the year 1963, and then I want all of our troops out by the end of 1964, which basically he was ending the Vietnam War. So both he and Martin Luther King got the same people mad at him, and the same people who just would not, they said, no way. This is our money. This is food off of our table, and we're not going to let you do this.
Wow. Well, it makes absolute sense.
Yeah, it does. When you really think about it, there ain't no other way. There ain't no other reason why they would have done that. See, when you really consider the common sense aspect of the whole thing, you know, you got killers, you got murders, you got criminals, and you got people in our government who work with them. And you got a president who's taking everything away from him. He fired Allen Dulles, who was the head of the CIA, who was part of that oversight of all that stuff. And he and King both made enemies that were vicious, evil people who did not care about life. If you got in their way, they would kill you in a minute and not think twice about it. And that's what happened.
So is it your belief that the government knew exactly what happened to King and Kennedy and just decided to make up another story?
Well, J. Edgar Hoover definitely knew. He was all, him and Lyndon Johnson, they both knew. They were both very much part of it. Not everybody. Now, not most people in government didn't know, because it's not their job to know certain things, you know. Most people that work for the government, they're just government employees. And even people in the United States who have never heard what I'm talking about, they've only read what they've seen in history books, so they believe what they believe because they what they think is the truth, you know. So I don't blame people for not knowing this, because they're not me. They didn't have an opportunity to see, you know, to study the files and to talk to the people and to find out these things. But yeah, there were people in the government that definitely knew and worked hard to keep it from ever getting known by the people of the United States of America.
Wow. So tell me why you think it's really important right now to tell this story and to make it a movie.
Well, It just so happened that these things are coming together now. I have two partners in Georgia now, a man named Miles Nyman and a man named Patrick Wood. And earlier, late last year, we began to form a company, and we have now formed a company called RWN LLC, which we're setting up to make the movie MLK, The Gary Rebel Story. So we're right now putting that together. We've got actors, we've got producers, we've got, you know, people already attached to it. We're developing the financing to make that movie. And it just, the timing is just something that happened. I didn't plan it this way, but it's absolutely for sure that the timing is right for this movie. I mean, we're seeing more, more divisiveness and more hate in this country than we have seen as far back as I can remember, except maybe when I was in high school in the early, in the 60s. But even that, back then, it wasn't as bad as it is today, because back then, at least we had a president, that tried to do what was right. And right now, we've got a president that don't care about anything but what he wants. So, yeah, it's more dangerous today than it's ever been. So it's good to get made and get out, yeah.
Oh wow! Well, my interest is really piqued, and I'm glad to talk to you about this. And it's a great story. It's a great story, and it, and like you said, it makes absolute sense when it comes down to the real reason why it happened.
That's right. That's right.
Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness!
So I touch on it in the book, To Live or Maybe Not, on the essay part of it. Yeah, I don't give the full breadth and depth of it, but I start the process of getting the truth out.
So tell us, how does you don't have to give it away, but kind of how does it end in the book, To Live or Maybe Not?
Well, after I finished in 1977, what had happened was my brother got killed, my 19-year-old brother. My mother called me and said, Gary, Ray is my, his name was Cecil Ray Killingame Jr. He was my half-brother, but he was my brother. I grew up with him.
Right.
He was my little brother. And she called me and said, he's dead. I found him hanging in the garage. So I went down to Florida. I was living in Nashville. I went down to Florida and I began asking questions. I had a reporter first at the police department, and they showed me what they had, which was a picture of his neck and the burn mark, the rope gun on his neck. And then they showed me a song. We were both songwriters, so I knew we were songwriters. They showed me lyrics to a song that they'd been working on. I said, this is a suicide note. Well, I knew it was not a suicide note. And I knew he was, because I just talked to him a few days before. I knew he was planning to come to Nashville to see me. So I knew he didn't commit suicide. But then I got a newspaper reporter to go around and canvass the neighborhood, go from door to door and ask them if they had seen anything. And I wanted a witness, and I wanted someone with me. So the house, we lived on, like, right near the corner. But there was not a, but there was a house on the other side at his backyard looked into our backyard. So we'd ask a few, and then we got around to that house, and the lady, when she answered the door, we told her what we want. I said, this is a newspaper reporter from the Orlando Sentinel. I forget the name of the newspaper now, but it was the Orlando newspaper. And she invited us in. She said, come in. She said, you need to talk to my daughter. And she called her daughter out. She looked like she was maybe 12 years old. And she sat down, and when we sat on the sofa, we could see my backyard. You see our garage and our back door. We had a Florida room on the back with like most of the glass enclosed. And it just opened up, and then the door to the garage was right there to the right. And the little girl told me, she said, I saw two men carry your brother. Carrie Ray was her friend. She knew that. She said, Carrie Ray, out the back door into the garage before he was found hanging in there. And he was limp.
Wow.
Like he was already dead.
Wow.
So I knew then that Ray had been murdered because of the fact that I was investigating the Martin Luther King assassination. Then a few days later, some members of the mob called me and had me come to Miami. Then I had the Fountain Blue Hotel there. I met him in the pool area, and we went to an estate there, someone there at Miami. And there I met with someone over the phone over an intercom and told me to be a good boy and quit investigating the King assassination. And I said, well, I don't need it. They said, you're looking to be wearing some cement shoes. And I said, well, I don't really threaten that easily. And he said, well, yeah, but you don't want something to happen to your wife and kids like happened to your brother.
Wow. Gary, you are very, very interesting. And your story is exciting. And I'm glad that you're telling the story. And thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking about your book. So tell us, how can other people get your book?
Well, it's really available everywhere. You just Google it and you'll find it on, they have copies at all the major, iTunes, Apple Books has it, Amazon has it. Most bookstores, if you go in and ask what they'll either be able to order a copy or get you a digital copy, an e-book of it. So it's available all over the world right now.
Right now. Well, that's great. I'm so glad to hear about it, and I'm enjoying the book. I'm actually really enjoying the book. So, are you on social media platforms? How can we follow you?
I have Facebook. A lot of my things is under the name of Jongler Pictures, or Jongler, Jongler. That's my company, Jongler Pictures. So a lot of times you'll find me through there. But if you just Google Gary Revell, R-E-V-E-L, or Rebel, you can pronounce it either way, by the way. My name is R-E-V-E-L. Back now, people used to say Rebel, but it's Revell or Rebel, either one's fine. But yeah, you can just Google my name and you'll find all kind of stuff about me, about the assassinations. And then I investigated the JFK assassination, then the Robert Kennedy assassination, then I investigated John Lennon assassination, and then I investigated the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan. So I'm making movies about all of that.
Oh, wow. Well, we are going to follow you. We are going to be listening to you. And I would love for you to come back again and be on To Marvel With Love. We really appreciate you. And thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, dear. God bless you.
All right, now. You can have a great day and a great weekend.
Okay.
All righty. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, y'all, that was an amazing interview. I know that we were having some technical difficulties, but I was able to talk to Mr. Revell about his book. And that book is really interesting. And it's called To Live or Maybe Not by Gary Revell. And that's R-E-V-E-L. And he's also doing a movie on the story about Martin Luther King's assassination. And I really like, you know, we've always said that that it was something else, you know, in the death of King. So get that book, and I got it. You can get it on Amazon as well, and it's called To Live or Maybe Not by Gary Revell. So I want to thank him for being on the show today.